this issue, they went directly to Jen Lewis because she was one of their best new chefs. And she gave the sort of her list of restaurants. That's why we use people like Jen Lewis, because they have real credibility in these markets. This is a story that we came up with, the team came up with the new streetcar on the east side. They came up with ideas of what tourists could do if they rode the streetcar over there, pitched it to Via Magazine, which is AAA's regional publication, and all of a sudden we have an article about great things to do on the east side of the river for tourists. We are also giving the East Side Loop, the Portland Streetcar, an award this year at the Travel Portland's Award Breakfast for their promotion of the ability to do tourism on that side of the river. So we're excited about the East Side and all the potential there, too. You remember that the TID funds started being collected in hotels with 50 rooms or more in October. You know, our first goal is to really drive business in that November-December time period and January through March time period when the hotels really do have the need. And as you heard earlier, that did work this year. The hoteliers who pay that fee really manage those funds, and they've been very helpful with us in directing these programs. So when we started this, we went to Seattle, Vancouver, BC, and San Francisco and did focus groups. And we asked those people, what do you think about Portland in the winter? Would you come here? The San Franciscans said, you know, we have a lot of different options. We are going to go south. We love Portland, but we're probably not your first market. Seattle and Vancouver, BC said, it rains here. We love Portland for the weekend. Give us an excuse to come down. So we came up with the Portland Passport. And you can see it touches every part of the city. There's a foodie experience. We had 8 businesses that participated. While we didn't redeem a ton of these, the press loved this. The number one redemption was the Portland Cream Donut at Voodoo Donuts. Brunch Box, a food card. Food card was number 2, and Olympic Provisions, which was the most expensive for either a salami or a chocolate salami, was number 3. So it really did get folks out into every part of the city to enjoy this. We expanded our presence with Expedia this year, and you can see the numbers at the bottom, 36,000 room nights. As we do the advertising, and I'll show you one in just a moment, we really drive to travelportland.com, but really what our job is really drive the experience, the desire to come to Portland. We don't care where they book. And in this instance, Expedia was a great partner of ours and did a terrific job of booking those room nights. The next 2 advertisements were done by Wyden and Kennedy, and it was very generous of Travel Oregon, who had some assets to allow us to leverage those and use those. We ran these in Seattle in places like Biggest Loser, Modern Family, and Grimm, and in Vancouver, BC. We were on Bones, 60 Minutes, Private Practice, and a few others. And this is one of the advertisements.
Here in Portland, we make books, boots, hand-built bikes, bacon donuts, and beer. And best of all, we don't charge any sales tax. So come visit this weekend, or soon, or whenever. Totally up to you.
Wyden did a very nice job with these. We were very pleased. And these numbers are actually first quarter. We had the extra revenue number came in yesterday. You can see we had a 6.3% increase out of the TID hotels, and that's just what we could count in our reports. And more importantly, when you look at that, what that quarterly increase meant, an extra $4.8 million worth of revenue, again, in what we can count. The city's tax collections are $240,000 extra just in one quarter, and we anticipate that will grow over the course of time. You can see the total tax collections of the 12.5% in the city of Portland are over $600,000 additional to the amount that was already collected. So very, very nice increases, and our job really is to drive that business and so that the tax collections are made. Here's the other advertisement we did.
We didn't invent the food cart in Portland. We're just perfecting it. So come visit this weekend, or soon, or whenever. Totally up to you.
What we heard in both Seattle and in Vancouver was that food carts are big, beer was very, very big, and certainly the tax-free shopping were top of mind for those folks. So we really wanted to try and stay true to what they were interested in. Obviously, social media, online banners were very important. You can see here we used an online banner on Kumal Tours Portlandia with a lot of over 20 million impressions. Wyden produced also with us 25 short spots that we pushed out on many social media channels, and they really did have huge viewing. Alexander Barrett is the star of these, and he wrote a book called This is Portland, 13 Essays About the City You've Heard You Should Like. And here's one of the videos.
I'm Alexander Barrett, and right now I'm going to tell you about one of Portland's greatest features, no sales tax. If you bought a $1,000 computer in Seattle, you'd have to pay 9.5% sales tax. But if you bought that computer in Portland and imagined you bought it in Seattle, then you'd have enough money left over to buy 7 boxes of Campfire cologne, 25 lattes from Barista, 31 slices of Sizzle Pie's D-Beat cheese pizza, 23¾ heavily used paperbacks from Powell City of Books. Or you could just go to the bank, get 9,500 pennies, and roll around in them like you're some kind of eccentric millionaire. I might prefer the pizza.
A little quirky, but they got tons of great press also. From Tripster, they said, you now need a passport to visit Portland, but it's not because Portlandia is actually a foreign country. It's because they have some cool freebies to give you. We had over 31 clips, LA Times, USA Today, Seattle, 75 million circulation there. So this was a very successful campaign. Our website had 48% more visits in that time period, which was exactly what we wanted and really drive that inspiration. Then this is another of the Alexander Barrett videos, and frankly, this is the quirkiest, the most Portland one, and I think you'll get it.
Oh, hi. I'm Alexander Barrett, and I have a confession to make. Portland is a city of beards, and sadly, I cannot grow one. But I get by with a series of artificial beard pieces. Let me take you through them now. This is a utilitarian. It's the model I'm wearing right now. It's more of an everyday beard, you know, going to the office, driving around. Here we have the Southern General. I usually wear this one on formal occasions, fundraisers, galas, what have you. This is the Indie Rocker. Sometimes I strap a guitar case on my back and walk down Hawthorne Boulevard when I want to feel cool. Here is the Yankee Gentleman, perfect for first dates and job interviews. And finally, we have the Optimist. It's more of a feel-good beard. It's great for Friday nights and weekends.
There are 25 of these, and they're on our YouTube channel, and the response has been really phenomenal to those. You know, as we look to the future, Travel Oregon does their bounty campaign September, October. They do an outdoor campaign April, May that Portland obviously is a piece of. So we have the ability to buy more of the Portland part of the message there and then come back in the November, December, January, February, March time period with a more retail message and really drive those people to come spend, shop, and stay in our hotels. International tourism is the number one U.S. export, and we're uniquely placed with the direct service to both Amsterdam and to Tokyo. We're the smallest U.S. city with that service. So it's really key that we work in those international markets and do a lot of that branding. We were lucky recently to have Governor Kitzhaber go with us to Amsterdam for that celebration of the 5-year anniversary, but then on to ITB in Berlin, which is the world's largest tourism trade show. 26 buildings of cities selling themselves to tour operators, and I've got a short video on that.
Destinations really exploiting itself a bit like that as well. I think that in that sense, Oregon would really fit my kind of clients.
It's really interesting over the years of coming to the show how you build relationships and develop relationships with the client. The product managers and the travel operators here do a remarkable job to their clients in selling and promoting the Pacific Northwest and Oregon. And so when we meet with them, they have a genuine interest in what we have to offer.
We are honored to have with us this year the governor of the state of Oregon. And it is my privilege right now to introduce him to you.
You can land in Portland on a great nonstop flight from Amsterdam within 2 hours. You can be sipping wine in the Glen Valley. You can be skiing on Mount Hood in July. You can be at the coast, or you can be windsurfing in the Columbia River Gorge. So we're hoping that you will come and experience this for yourselves.
Well, it's great to be able to have the opportunity to work with our travel partners, Travel Oregon and Travel Portland. It strengthens our message. It helps us leverage our dollars better. And with Portland being a gateway community to our beautiful state, it's an easy sell.
It was great to have the governor come with us, and he did a terrific job of promoting Oregon to the world when he was there. We don't get those opportunities as often as we'd like. You'll note this is PR that we've done internationally, and you'll see Haystack Rock, and it says Pretty Portland. Those foreign visitors really do understand that Portland's the gateway city, but they want to see all that there is to see in the state. So it's very important that we in Portland be great neighbors and great partners with folks like Lorna and Newport and throughout the state. And we were lucky to, while we were in Amsterdam, to travel to Utrecht, which is Portland's newest friendship city. And we worked with Noah Siegel in the mayor's office, and we met there with their city tourism folks. We met with the university and with Tourism Utrecht and really talked about what are our shared values, how can we help each other out, and we explored some ways to do that, and I think we will. This is a picture of us with Danielle Behrens, who's the tourism advisor for the city of Utrecht. We really do use those sister city relationships. Downtown Marketing Initiative. This is another hat that we wear at Travel Portland, and it's a great public-private partnership. It's worked very, very well. It's paid for by parking revenues generated in the central city. And I want to thank this group of the City Council for passing the Downtown Marketing Initiative contract for the next 4 years. We're excited about that. And the beauty of this program is that we're able to leverage Travel Portland dollars to leverage these messages outside the city, but within the city, it's really to make sure that the central city downtown is vibrant and well visited. And it's all about businesses. One of the things we did last year was created the logo and branding for the Pioneer District and got those signs up, which really, I think, defines that retail core. In September, we had Fashions Night Out, which was the kickoff to the fall retail season. The retailers love that one. They really go crazy to be a part of that. During Feast, during the food festival, came up with Appetizing Oregon, and to drive those people downtown into restaurants and really connect that food message that we do so well here in Portland. Obviously, the holiday campaign is the largest thing we do. It was an exciting year this year with that. We had over 25% increase in our page views on the website. This is some of the advertising and banner ads we did, the online engagement via Pinterest and Pin It to Win It. And the last video that we have is an advertisement that we did for the holiday campaign.
Once upon a holiday lived a fairy who didn't believe in magic. To dispel her doubts, her mother took her to an enchanted land. Here the skies danced. Mice and wooden dolls came to life. Even the air filled with song. And everywhere the girl went, delights chased her. From that day forward, the fairy believed. And the magic of the season lives inside her still.
The holiday for me is all about tugging on the heartstrings, and I think North, the agency that did those, did a really nice job. And we really do try and reinforce the retail message. Come downtown and shop. Not only just enjoy yourself here, but come down and shop and frequent those businesses. As we moved into February, March, we had the Lights Dinner Downtown campaign, which was an evolution of the Winter Arts campaign. Clearly, those arts groups rely on us, and certainly the dining piece of that. We just finished April Spring Into Color, which was the spring retail kickoff, and I think that the retailers tell us they are having a very, very good spring, so we always like to hear that. And then we're getting ready to start June Dining Month here very soon. It'll be the fourth year of that, and it's a very Portland downtown central city-centric program, but all restaurants in the city can participate. We started 4 years ago with 48 restaurants. We're now up to 75. So it's certainly a campaign that those folks rely on. It's $29 for three courses this year, and it's a really terrific campaign. And I guess lastly, I would thank my board of directors and some of the staff that are here today. I have great support from them and direction. The staff does an amazing job, and I get to show the fun stuff. So thank you for letting us come and talk about what we do for the city and the businesses in the city, and we appreciate all your help in that.
Thanks. Great report. Questions? Thanks very much, Jeff.
Great, thanks.
Anyone else that's here to testify on this item? If not, before we vote, I have a proclamation. So I'd like to read that. It says, whereas travel matters to the nation's economic prosperity and its image abroad, to business wealth, and to individual travelers. Whereas travel to and within the United States provides significant economic benefits for the nation, generating $2.0 trillion in economic output in 2012. With $855 billion spent directly by travelers that spurred an additional $1.1 trillion in other industries, And whereas travel is among the largest private sector employers in the United States, supporting 14.6 million jobs, including 7.7 million directly in the industry and 6.9 million in other industries. Whereas traveler spending directly generated tax revenues of $129 billion for federal, state, and local governments, funds used to support essential services. And whereas the Portland region accounts for $4 billion in travel-generated spending, tax receipts, employment, and payroll, and 30,100 jobs in the industry. And whereas international travel to the United States is the nation's largest single export industry, greater than the export of business services, machineries, computers, and electronic products, motor vehicles, and agriculture. In 2012, travel generated $168 billion in exports, generating $50 billion in balance of travel trade surplus for the United States. And whereas meetings, events, and incentive travel are core business functions that help companies strengthen their performance, averaging a return of investment of $12.50 in profits and $3.80 in revenue for every dollar spent on corporate travel. And whereas leisure travel, which accounts for more than three-quarters of all trips taken in the United States, spurs countless benefits to travelers' creativity, cultural awareness, education, productivity, relationships, and wellness, and whereas travel is a catalyst that moves the nation's economy forward, now, therefore, I, Charlie Hales, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim May 4th to May 12th to be National Tourism and Travel Week in Portland and encourage all residents to observe this week.
Hear, hear.
So thank you all, and let's take a roll call on the resolution.
It's a presentation.
I'm sorry, I thought there was a resolution attached.
No.
There is not. Thank you very much.
I would just like to say something, so for not voting, I just want to really say that the hoteliers, by taxing themselves to form the Tourism Improvement District, have really shown the results that we really can attract people to Portland in those December, November, January, February, March months. A lot of us probably were skeptics about that, but thanks to the great, careful market research done by Wyden and Kennedy and all the people at Travel Portland, the successful campaigns, which you saw tidbits of, and the focus on Vancouver, BC, and Seattle, you know, putting San Francisco aside for the moment. We'll get them sometime, but really focusing where we can do that, and the bang for the buck really showed. And I think Eric Paul's putting it into context that increased travel, staying in hotels in Portland in those months means more full-time employment for its employees. That's a very important thing for all of us up here on this dais. So thank you very much for that.
Thanks, Commissioner. Other comments?
I might comment also, there are few 8 a.m. quarterly meetings that I agree to do. And there is just the Visitor Development Fund Board that I actively look forward to. And thank you, Sabrina, for your leadership, and Commissioner Craddock from Councillor Craddock from the Metro Council, who's a good partner on that. It's very important. This is jobs. This is money. This is not just fun and games, although you make it fun. So I appreciate that, and I echo Commissioner Saltzman's comments that this is an important part of our economy. Some of the best visitors are those who come and spend a lot of money and then go away again. So
I remember a governor said something like that.
Something like that, yes. And they can get from the airport on our wonderful light rail system, and we've been able to figure out with TriMet about making sure that conventioners can still use their convention passes to travel on TriMet, which is a good investment because people do come. And I hope that we will be able to ever expand our convention capacity by providing more hotel rooms for them and facilities so that we can make sure that all of our hotels citywide and region-wide stay busy year-round. Thank you very much for your work.
Mayor, I just want to add my thanks to Jeff and his team, to our partners on the board, our hoteliers. We're very proud of our city, and you bring distinction to our city. And I met with a number of hoteliers the other day, and I also, Councillor Craddock, you'll appreciate this. I observed that it's my impression, since we go to a lot of lunches and dinners together in hotels, that there's been an upgrade in the quality of the food, and particularly the healthy options, the healthy alternatives. And so we appreciate that. And thanks for all your good work.
Councillor Craddock, any comments before we close? Sure. Come.
Thank you. Just to say thank you, too, for all that you do to help. Metro is the owner and operator of several venues, the Oregon Convention Center, the Oregon Zoo, the Portland, or the operator of the Performing Arts Facility and the Expo. Thank you for all you do to help us promote tourism in the Metro region, and particularly to the hoteliers themselves, like you said, for taxing themselves to be able to make this happen. We really look forward to, as we move forward with our headquarters hotel plans, and hopefully get your support for that, and even bring more tourists to this region. So thank you very much for your support and being a partner in all of this.
Thank you. Same to you. Thank you all. Great report. Great results.
Mr. Mayor, I just wanted to add, Jeff, that the ads that Whiting Kennedy produced were, among other things, a reminder of the importance of our fake beard industry, which we all support.
There's an economic impact. Great. Thank you all. Keep up the good work. Okay, so let's take up, we have some second reading items, I think, that we ought to get to before we lose a quorum entirely. So let's see, which are they?
7-8 and 379.
378, 379. Exactly right. So let's take up 378, please.
Commissioner Fritz, I believe we have an amendment on 8.
Why don't you remind me what that is?
My understanding is that your staff and my staff have agreed to slap an emergency clause on this, and so I would move to put the emergency clause
I haven't read the title yet.
Oh, excuse me.
378, authorize acquisition of the Eagle Point property for tax purposes and an agreement with the Trust for Public Land.
Thank you, Commissioner Fish. We had a robust discussion last week and a lot of testimony about this property. Universal support for purchasing the property, some concern about whether we could save the historic house on the property. I met with Director Mike Abate and have heard from others. So before we voted, we got a message late yesterday from the Friends of Terwilliger saying that they are now hoping to save the house. But in discussions with various staff, it sounds like that can't happen in the time frame that's needed in order to close the deal, and that there is some potential for losing the purchase of the property should we delay the sale. And so I wanted, first of all, to ask my colleagues if anybody else is inclined to delay. And so hearing none, even though I would last week did express some interest in looking into it, I have had the extra week, which I appreciate, and so I move to add the emergency clause.
Second.
Second. Vote on the addition of the emergency clause.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Approved. And vote on the item, please.
Fish?
This is a happy day. This is a opportunity that's been discussed and debated for a long time, and I want to begin by thanking the residents of Southwest Portland, particularly Friends of Terwilliger, who were such stalwart advocates for making this happen. Mike Houck's not here today, but I'd be remiss if I didn't give a shout-out to John Charles Olmsted, because every time we do something like this, we're reminded that this guy over 100 years ago saw the future before we did, and he actually had this vision for a wildlife corridor and sight lines that ran on the west side from what's now Forest Park all the way to Tryon Creek. And last year we had the chance to fill in an important piece of this with the working with our friends at Metro to acquire Riverview Cemetery, a significant chunk to fill in that wildlife corridor. This is another important piece. And so thanks to John Charles Olmsted, thanks to the stalwart support of the community. And also I want to do a shout out, Mayor, for a tool that we use to acquire these kinds of parcels, and that's called systems development charges. And it's thanks to the more robust development we're seeing, we're generating SDCs, which then can be used to acquire legacy parcels like this. And I also want to thank the crack team at Parks for putting this together. This is really a good win for everybody. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, the acquisition of this property is a real asset for the Terwilliger Parkway, and I want to thank not only Parks, but you know, most importantly, Friends of Terwilliger. I'm astounded last week by the story that Jay Maurer told us of just somebody was out walking around and noticed the for sale sign up on this key piece of property with tremendous viewpoints. And so to get right on that and for Parks to be right there in tow with the money to make it happen and the Trust for Public Lands to really sort of provide the glue that makes all these complicated deals work so well is a real testament to all of those parties. And this is something that this acquisition is something that we will look back on as being one of our proudest moments. And I can't wait to get up into that piece of property and see all the tremendous views that it has. So this is a real good addition for the public. Please to vote aye.
Novick?
Well, I have to say that I'm a little appalled that Commissioner Fish is so shamelessly pandering to the pro-systems development charges crowd. But having said that, I'll vote aye.
Fritz.
Well, thank you for the additional week for discussion and indeed for the community advocates who've worked long and hard for that. And indeed, it was one of the Friends of Terwilliger's supporters, or several of them, that alerted Parks to this property being for sale, which is the second time in the last few months that Parks has been particularly nimble, the other being in Palhouse Gilbert, of responding to citizens when for sale signs go up and being able to, with the systems development charges, which are reasonable and appropriate and used for the proper purposes, being able to purchase key properties. So although there has been some controversy about the whether or not we can keep the house, and I am always sad when we lose historic buildings, I think nobody disagrees that this is a hugely important piece of property and that we should not jeopardize the potential purchase for the maybe as to whether the house could be saved. And so with that, I vote aye.
Hales?
Well, this is a great piece of work. And bravo to Parks and to the Friends of Terwilliger and to that amazing organization, Trust for Public Land, that comes in as a key partner to make these kinds of things happen. The other thing I was really struck by in the discussion last week and in the presentation was that we're still operating off of this great 110-year-old Parks plan, and that people in the Bureau have it in their desk, and we say, oh, yeah, here's one more that we're supposed to have done by now. And eventually we get around to them in one way or another. And I don't know if there's any other city that's still actively managing a plan document that's that old and not just treasuring it as an artifact but actually making real changes in the fabric of the city with it. But I think it's really cool that that's the case about Portland. And then the other thing I was struck by in the presentation last week is I've been around parks issues for a while now, and I don't recall another discussion in which Emmanuel Miche's name came up as often as it did here last time. And I think he's the unsung hero of the Portland Park system. And I hope one of the things we do in the next few years is find something to name after Emmanuel Miche, the guy who had more impact on the Portland Park system than any of us and than most other people as well, and who has not yet gotten the proper recognition. Yeah, he's got a kind of a strange and hard-to-pronounce name, but tough. He's done a wonderful thing for our city. And if you look at Laurelhurst Park or Mount Tabor Park or Selwood Park or a lot of the other places where he turned the Olmsted Plan into real places, we owe it to this guy. So thanks for all of your good work. I'm very pleased to see this wonderful improvement to a great park system. Aye. Great. Thank you. Now, item 379, please.
Authorize the Water Bureau to acquire a permanent easement necessary for construction of the Fulton Pump Station Improvements Project through direct negotiation or exercise of the city's eminent domain authority.
Second reading and roll call.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Hales?
I'm sure we'll do an excellent job of managing this project. This is the authority we need to move forward. Aye. Okay, we have a quorum for a few more minutes. Let's take up 376.
Authorize a surcharge to the Central East Side Industrial District Area Parking Permit Program.
Good morning. My name is Marnie Glick, Bureau of Transportation. Almost a year ago, City Council adopted the Central East Side Parking Management Plan. The plan was intended as a way to address parking and transportation issues in the Central East Side. The plan called for a number of things, one of which was to create a TMA, or a Transportation Management Association, for the Central East Side. The CEIC stepped right up and formed the Transportation and Parking Advisory Committee, a subcommittee of the CEIC, to function as their TMA.
They've been a very active committee and have been meeting regularly to implement the parking management plan. Also, since stakeholders recognize that the Central East Side Meter District would not generate any net meter revenue for several years, the plan called for adding a surcharge to the base cost of the area parking permit in the Central East Side as a way to fund transportation and parking management services. The ordinance before you authorizes a surcharge, and the CEIC, in consultation with the city, is recommending a $10 increase for permits for this year. We estimate, depending on the number of permits sold, to generate between $50,000 and $60,000. Members of the Central East Side Industrial Council Board have been great partners. They've been committed to making the plan successful. And several members, well, actually, we had several members, but now we have one. Peter Stark is a board member and also serves as the executive director of the Transportation and Planning Advisory Committee.
So. Thank you, Marnie, and thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm pleased to be here. I do need to correct Marnie. I did give up my board position so I could become the executive director of this committee. And Marnie actually covered many of the things I was going to talk about. So let me just tell you that we have here a unique opportunity. This is a district that has been very active, as I'm sure you realize. We also have seen a considerable amount of development of late, and we have also seen a number of concerns coming from many of the businesses about the ability to park their employees, the ability to continue to do business. Both transportation and parking needs are really critical. About 10 years ago, when I was the president of the Central East Side Industrial Council, I recognized that we'd need to have something like a TMA to help us go through this transition that we're now going through. The TMA is critical. This surcharge is really just a way for the committee to continue to function until such time that we start to grow and maybe look at some other metering resources to actually implement some real plans. So we see this as sort of an interim to allow us to continue to do what we're doing. I'll tell you, at last night's Transportation and Parking Advisory Committee meeting, we had about, I think, 20 people that attended, and we have at least 15 that attend regularly. So this is a very active, high participation by members of the community and the neighborhoods to see this thing be successful. So this vote is actually rather critical, which is why I wanted to be here. Juliana Lukasik, our president, could not be present. She had a lunch engagement. She was here until about 11 o'clock. So this is very important for us, and we hope that you support this ordinance.
Thanks, Peter. Questions for Marnie or Peter?
Just for the benefit of the public, what does the $60 permit fee pay for?
The $60 permit fee pays for the basic administration of the area parking permit program. We have, I think, 10 or 11 districts in the area. It includes meetings, enforcement, the cost of the permit, and all the services associated with providing the area parking permit program. It's a cost of service model, so there's no extra revenues generated through the APP program.
Thank you. And then the revenue from the meters, what is that going to?
Meter revenue goes into GTR, general transportation revenue. It's used to support transportation services.
And it's my understanding that right now there isn't any net revenue because it's paying for the meters. So that's why the Transportation Committee is suggesting this $10 surcharge.
We only installed a few of the pay stations that were recommended in the plan, probably about 25% of the metered the spaces to ultimately be metered actually have a meter. There is a small amount of revenue being generated, but that is going towards operating the machines, maintenance.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the outreach and indeed the cohesion of the Central East Side Industrial Council. You have a remarkable area, and I think you work very hard to work with all the businesses. There are so few residences in the area that is possible and works well. I am going to support this surcharge. I would caution that this is not something that could be easily replicated in other areas of the city in terms of adding funding for the transportation management associations that may be in other areas, that we need to be very careful about how we ask people to pay for the use of the public realm and to make sure that the revenue that derived from that goes for the
appropriate purpose, as you said, enforcement, administration for the permits, and then going to the Transportation Committee in the Central East Side on this one. So it's another step forward in this particular case. I will want more discussion before we think about expanding this in other areas of the city. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks you both. Any other questions?
Yeah, I'm curious, how much money over the course of a year do you think the $10 surcharge will raise, and what exactly will it be spent on?
Every person who purchased a permit would be charged the extra $10. We've sold about 6,000 permits in Zone G. We don't know how many permits we will sell, given that the price will be higher. The $10 per permit would be set aside, and still to be developed is a memorandum of understanding with the TMA, which we will work, the city will work with the TMA to specifically identify the projects and services that we would want to contract with them to provide in that area.
But what kind of projects and services are contemplated?
Well, first of all, the committee itself requires someone to manage the process, and there are a series of items that the TPAC would like to pursue, including purchasing some consulting time to work with these committees to make sure that we're on the right track. And there are, I could list some experts, but we're thinking about hiring some experts to do that. I should point out, too, that there really would be limited funding. In other words, we're going to reach a point where we won't be able to sell more permits than there's actually parking available. And so part of the charge of the TPAC is to manage, that's the acronym for the committee, is to manage the number of permits that we're able to actually put back into the system. And at the same time, because not everyone will have parking, we've got to come up with solutions to better manage the parking system, which might include modifying how cars are parked or creating some programs to encourage employers to purchase TriMet passes. I mean, eventually, if we do have metering money, the hope is that we can actually use those funds to offset some of those costs back to the businesses. But to get there, this committee needs a little bit of seed money just to keep us going. And the $60,000 a year we see is just enough to buy maybe some consulting time, keep the committee on track. And as Marty pointed out, all of those expenses would go through the scrutiny of the MOU and PBOT. So it's not just a give us money. It's a request, and we're paid on those requests, and it's reviewed.
Just I don't mean to, belabor this, but what kind of consulting services would you need to buy that would be above and beyond the expertise that the Bureau of Transportation can provide to you?
Well, we're discussing how to expand the metered area. As you can imagine, it's a very difficult, complex, and touchy subject for many businesses. And at the meeting last night, it became clear that there is a benefit of having meters in some locations, and there can also be a detriment. And we know that there is an intent to expand the meters sometime this summer. And we had, in fact, just had a discussion on the hall. We've got to get a better handle on, precisely where those meters should be placed, how they would best benefit the commercial and retailers that need them, and where they shouldn't be located, where they might impact adjacent industrial users that just need employee parking. And we were looking at possibly using somebody like a Rick Williams, who is a nationally recognized expert in dealing with parking management. I'm not saying that Rick would be the person, but somebody like that, and that we would use the funds to acquire some of his time to help our committee go through this process.
Could I just add, some of the services that LOI TMA provides for us is that they have done turnover and parking studies, occupancy studies on street and off street. They have built bike racks. I think they've had discussions about subsidizing transit passes for employees in their area. So it can be a variety of things that they could spend the money on that would fall within parking and transportation services.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Anyone else just signed up to testify on this?
I show two people, Peter Stark and Juliana Lukasik.
Juliana unfortunately had a luncheon engagement, okay. And I'm here. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate you being here, and thanks for your patience. So we'll take a roll call on the emergency ordinance.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Thank you for your work and for being here today. Aye.
Hales?
Appreciate this constructive partnership between the Bureau and a business organization to allocate a scarce resource, becoming scarcer. So
yeah.
Appreciate the partnership. Thank you. Aye.
Thank you.
Okay, we have one more item, which is an ordinance and a presentation from Parks.
377, provide for civil penalties for violation of leash and scoop regulations and authorize commissioner in charge to adopt policies and procedures for implementation of civil penalties.
Mayor, commissioners, we'll try to move efficiently through this. Appreciate your patience through this. My name is Warren Jimenez. I am the Assistant Director of Portland Parks and Recreation. And it's a pleasure to be here with my colleague Eileen Argentina, who is the Parks and Rec Services Manager. And we'll work on getting the PowerPoint going. But in the meantime, I believe you have paper copies, so we'll continue to press forward as we move through this. We don't have any fun videos for you, like travel Portland, but we do have pictures of doggies.
Okay.
And so I see you.
It always works too.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Dog owners and their pets are frequent visitors to our parks, and as a system, we're trying to manage multiple users as are those users access our parks, with the ultimate goal of providing health, safety, and friendly user parklands throughout our system. We want to be sure that they're enjoyable for all visitors who access our parks. In essence, what's in front of you for your consideration today is to allow park rangers another tool to be able to do enforcement of leash and scoop laws. But to provide just a little bit of history and context to this, in 1995, City Council established the first off-leash area, which was established as one of the park amenities. Over the series of years, we have added to that. One of the key decisions coming out of City Council actually in 2004 was to add 33 off-leash areas over the years, and so we've done that over the years. And Portland consistently ranks first in the number of dog parks per capita with 5.5 per 100,000.
Next one, yeah. Just cover a couple of points here. The issue we're trying to address is the disregard for leash and scoop laws has become pretty common behavior. We receive more complaints about leash and scoop violations than any other type of behavior. More than 60 requests to staff in 2012, 200 complaints that came through the rangers in 2011. We have a number of stakeholder groups who have raised concerns about the lack of enforcement, including maybe many neighborhood associations, sports user groups, nature wildlife groups, and Portland Public Schools. And we hear a lot from respectful dog owners who also greatly are impacted by off-leash dogs approaching their pets. The changing this trend is going to require three things: ongoing education and engagement with owners, making sure we continue to provide top-notch services through our off-leash system, and effective enforcement.
So the code change in front of you is, again, an additional tool that for the park rangers. In essence, it would allow the commissioner in charge to enact this change. It would make leash and scoop violations a non-criminal offense, subject to a civil penalty of $150. It would eliminate the park exclusion or criminal charges for leash and scoop violations. Currently, that's the tool that the rangers have is only a park exclusion, which could lead to a criminal offense. This would eliminate that, and it would move to a civil penalty going forward.
We have had a fair amount of community involvement on this. The proposed code change was supported by PPNR's off-leash advisory group, which met monthly from March 2010 to June 2012. And their role was to provide guidance to us on how to encourage compliance, make sure the off-leash areas were functioning well, and to engage the dog community. The advisory group's term ended in June 2012, and in the final two meetings, they thoroughly reviewed the education, enforcement, and involvement approach to compliance, and they recommended that PPNR move forward with making the code change that's before you today. Advisory group meeting notifications were sent to an email list that included dog owners, neighborhood association, livability chairs, other community members who had expressed interest regarding dogs in parks, including those who had complained about a lack of enforcement. And response to the proposed change was overwhelmingly positive.
So the implementation of the change, if you approve it, in essence, is that we would continue to educate and build awareness on this issue. It would also include issuing the $150 fine. We've also developed an appeal process, which we'll touch on today, and continue to maintenance and improve the off-leash dog area. On the education enforcement component, we're in essence looking at two parallel approaches. One is a standard approach, and one is an intensive approach. And I'll just quickly touch on each one of those. The standard approach would be used as a baseline throughout the entire city. It would be on first contact, it would be a warning. And then on second contact, it would be issuing of the fine. The intensive approach would be for some of those more chronic noncompliance parks. In essence, what we'd focus on is continuing to do an extensive, more focused education outreach at the beginning of that. And then instead of issuing a warning following the outreach period, we'd be issuing the fine.
Doesn't that presuppose that it's the same people going to those parks all the time? What if it's a visitor who's hasn't been involved in all that outreach? Would you still fine on the first time?
Yes. That would be the plan. This would be for a specific period of time. We do a lot of advance warning. All of the areas do already have signage that talk about the rules, talk about the fine and citation. So this is really just trying to intervene in areas where we've just had a huge number of conflicts.
I'm wondering, why would we not do the warnings to find out is it repeat offenders at those parks? We just had that Travel Portland presentation. Somebody brings their dog. They don't notice the signs because people don't read signs, and they get slapped with a $150 ticket. It seems to me I'm going to get an email complaining about that.
I'm sure we could look at some way of tracking if there have been prior contacts and try to make sure that we're not capturing people in this that are not really the primary problem.
I would just encourage you to do for everybody first offense warning, but then after that.
In part to come up. Yeah, this is an important discussion, I think. So in this scenario where park ranger is, encountering somebody who's got their dog off leash, unlike a traffic stop, we can't require someone to identify themselves, but would we, in that situation, record the dog's tag number? How would we know it was a second contact when a different park ranger encounters that same person with their off-leash dog a week later?
Art Hendrick, security manager for Portland Parks and Recreation. So to answer the question, on every contact that we make, we ask for people to voluntarily give us their information, their identification. We also will record identification of the dog that we've come in contact with and see, in fact, if the dog has a license. So in many instances, we're recording that information. So to answer your question, Commissioner Fritz, about the visitor, certainly that's what we instruct our rangers to do, is really to use their discretion. And even in those intensive areas, if it's clear to us that, the person, it's their first time there, they're really unaware, we would just issue the warning. Again, our focus in the intensive areas really would be to make sure that we have plenty of signage. So I think folks entering the park and the different entry points would see clearly that, we were going to have rangers at the park, that they need to have their dogs on leash. So every contact that we make, we record that information. Certainly a person can refuse to give us that information, and in those instances, it's about 5% of our contacts.
And then how do you give them a ticket if they won't tell you their name?
We have a couple of different options, depending upon how they entered the park. If we see them enter a vehicle, we'll write the license plate down, and that's one way in which we have, you know, track folks for warning and exclusions. The other instance, which we use very rarely, is we can call for Portland police and compel them to, you know, the police can compel them for their identification. We don't think that that's necessarily a good use of police resources, quite frankly, and we would only do that if the person we felt posed a public safety risk just by their behavior. So in those instances, they would essentially walk, and there's not a lot we could do. One other option that we would use judiciously would be to take their photograph. And so we could then, in essence, not have their name, but have a photograph of the person. But again, that's not necessarily a tactic that we strongly encourage.
But it would help with an exclusion, but it wouldn't help with ticket.
Right.
So but why are you taking away the option of exclusion? Because if they won't tell you their name, they walked there, you can't find, and they don't have a tag.
Right.
You can't find out who they are. Why would you not want to keep out, well, yeah, we got to take your picture and you can't come to this park
anymore? So the exclusion would be taken away solely just for the off-leash. Now the situation in which you're talking about, if a person sort of refused to comply with park rules, they are now in violation of another park rule. And so that's a failure to obey. And so that would be an excludable offense. And that would be is what we would exclude the person for, would be just sort of that failure to really comply with the park rules. But if it's solely an issue of them not having their dog on leash or them not picking up, our primary goal really is to educate them and just to get their voluntary compliance. We're not really focused as much on the punitive aspects, but we do have some parks that are chronic where we have consistent folks not following the rules.
Maybe I'm missing something, but from what I've heard in the last few minutes, it sounds like people who are cooperative and voluntarily give you their names will get a $150 fine, and people who say the hell with you and refuse to give their names will wind up walking away without a fine. And that seems kind of unfair.
Well, it's just the challenge that we have given the role of not only the park ranger, but this is also an issue for animal control, is that there are some people who will refuse to be compliant with our role in terms of enforcing the code. And so we will make efforts to work with the police depending upon their resources and depending upon you know which instance we're talking about. But it is something that we frequently encounter where people will refuse to work with us around not just this issue but other park issues.
I had a contact about this from somebody who served on the Joint City County Animal Control Task Force, or whatever it was called, a couple of years ago, who raised a couple of concerns. One is that he's concerned about park rangers who haven't gone through DPSST training having law enforcement authority. Another is sort of a general concern that the city ceded animal control authority to the county some years ago in a general matter, and the task force suggested sort of ramping up licensing enforcement and the county using that to expand animal control enforcement. And so he's concerned that this is sort of abandoning that model. I also had a concern that was raised basically from my staff contacting Mike Oswalt at Multnomah County Animal Services, and he said that he hadn't seen this ordinance until like yesterday. Now, actually having seen it, he isn't really opposed to it, but it seems to me that on an issue like this where, I mean, there's definitely should be a close city council mm-hmm. relationship, I was concerned that Oswalt hadn't seen the ordinance before. So I'd like you to address all three of those issues.
Sure, I can start with the last one. Over a series of months, we've been talking with Multnomah County Animal Controls on this issue and making them aware in terms of what the proposal is. And then we went ahead and sent them the ordinance. So the major components in the framework of the ordinance has been clearly communicated to Multnomah Animal Control Services. And Art, I don't know if you want to touch a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so we've met not only with Mike Oswalt, but his staff, and we've had a close working relationship with some of the online staff in terms of this ordinance. So we've had discussions with the county for quite some time. I would like to speak on the issue of DPSST certification. All park rangers are DPSST certified as a requirement for employment.
Okay,
and we are certified by the state, and in fact, we go above and beyond what the required state certification is. So in addition to that, an aspect of that would be continuing to have training from Multnomah County Animal Control about animal issues, because the off-leash issue and the scoop issue are a very small slice of the kinds of animal issues that we see impacting folks within parks. So as I and Mike Oswald and I have agreed, is that we will be continuing to work with them on various issues, dangerous dogs probably being at the very top of that list, and work closely with them. I think in terms of what you're speaking to around the 2008 report, that really looked comprehensively at animal services. And I think over the last 10 years, we've worked with Multnomah County on the off-leash issue and have just found that we think that this approach is going to be more efficient and it's going to be more effective to getting the outcome that we're trying to look for, because this problem continues to grow.
I mean, wouldn't it be a lot easier, however, for you to operate and to enforce this ordinance, for example, if the county did ramp up its licensing requirements and there was a really concerted effort to make sure that dogs are licensed so you can take a picture of the license and find people that way?
Well, to that extent, I do think that any effort by the county to ramp up licensing efforts and for them to have more resources, my understanding is they have somewhere between 6 to 8 animal control officers for the entire county. In fact, over the past 10 years, have been one of the sources working in partnership with them to get people to be compliant. So every time we make contact, if a person doesn't have their dog registered, we will forward that information on to the county, and the county follows up to cite them or ask them to register their dog. So we will continue to work in partnership with the county about getting compliance from folks. But my understanding is over the years they've had limited resources to increase enforcement staff.
I just had one question. You mentioned taking someone's picture is kind of like maybe a last resort. I guess why wouldn't you take a picture of the person or a dog if they're saying, oh, I don't have my ID or anything like that? Because I think that there's something about people knowing that their picture exists that will make them a little more willing to be compliant the second time around. Commissioner, you don't use the picture. You're just taking the picture with the iPhone or whatever.
Yes, sure. Commissioner, I agree with you. And I guess the picture I want to give you is that our rangers, I think, are very good at, in the vast majority of cases, to get people to comply with us, even if they're resistant at the beginning. So I think our role primarily is to be educators and again, to get them to be compliant with the rules. And we will use those tactics. And when I say as a last resort, there are other things that we're going to try to do to get that person to be persuasive. And if we have individuals who are being, beyond obstinate and being, really sort of combative, then we will rely on our partners at the Police Bureau to support us in terms of gaining compliance.
Other questions for staff?
Just one more. I mean, the ordinance talks about fines of up to $150, but in the presentation it seemed like the assumption was that you'd go straight from warning to exactly $150?
Correct. That's what the current fee structure is now. So it would be a $150 fine.
Do you think that there might be, an argument for going from, say, a warning to $75 to $150 for a second offense or something like that?
I think there is an argument. I think what we would be doing under that case, though, is we've had the $150 fine in place since 2002, and so we would be losing that and having to have to build some more awareness around that aspect of the program.
But this ordinance gives the commissioner in charge some discretion, but not on that, right? Is that $150 in code?
Correct. It would be part of the code.
It isn't now?
I'm sorry?
It is now.
Yes.
Okay, so the $150 is in code already.
But this ordinance says up to, not to exceed 150. So it sort of seems to imply that there's, I took that to mean the commissioner in charge would have the discretion to arrange a structure that included fines of less than that.
That's what I read it to.
So currently, prior to last year, the fine was $150. So that's consistently what it's been in since 2002. If someone had their dog off leash, they would be given a $150 fine. Certainly, you know, how it reads, that's something that we could, you know, take a look at if council so chose.
How many times have we imposed that $150 fine?
Well,